Good morning, and welcome to the Thursday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Times the Brief is supported by Squarespace, providing tools for creative individuals and business owners to make a website. Squarespace includes hosting, e-commerce, and 24/7 customer care. Learn more at squarespace.com/thebrief. Pope Francis is a popular pope. A poll released Thursday from Quinnipiac University found that 66% of Americans have either a favorable or very favorable view of the pope, who arrives in America in late September. The pope's popularity crosses wide and often surprising swaths of American society. While it might not come as a shock that 87% of Catholics are fans of the Pope, 61% of Protestants and 63% of people who follow no religion count themselves as Francis fans. Pope Francis is sparking a resurgent confidence in the Catholic Church as more Catholics, Protestants, and those with no religion believe the Vatican is steering the Church in the right direction, Tim Malloy, assistant director of the poll, said in a statement. Pope Francis' leadership of the Catholic Church has presented a clear gender divide, with women in favor of the pontiff more than men. While 69% of female respondents had positive views of Pope Francis, 63% of males felt the same. The poll found that 76% of Catholic women felt the Catholic Church was moving in the right direction, compared to 62% of Catholic men. The gender divide played out again when adult Catholics were asked if church leaders were in touch with modern American Catholics. 57% of women felt so, compared to 47% of men. The poll's results come a day after the Pew Research Center released a survey of the changing state of American Catholicism. While 9 out of 10 American Catholics believe a household headed by married heterosexual parents is ideal, growing segments of the faith are willing to accept non-traditional families, whether they be unmarried heterosexuals, gay or lesbian couples, single parents, or divorced individuals. The Pew study points to an American Catholicism that is much more flexible than ever before and has embraced Pope Francis, whose popularity among even ex-Catholics and those who consider themselves cultural Catholics is strong, at 59% and 73% respectively. Francis' liberal bent and willingness to address contemporary social issues like gay marriage, abortion, poverty, and climate change have made him an icon that transcends the religion. And within the faith, Catholics believe the Church must address these issues, with overwhelming majorities saying the Catholic Church should allow for birth control and acceptance of divorce. Much of this support for the Church's direction came from millennials, with older generations, particularly those in the 65 and over bracket, being much more reluctant to bending from conservative views. But Catholics are increasingly positive that by 2050, the Church will change its views on contraception, cohabitation, and maybe even gay marriage, respondents said. This article posted by Tanya Basu.
There are few places in the world better suited for spectacle than the vast expanse of Beijing's Tiananmen Square. On September 3rd, in a grand military parade marking the 70th anniversary of Japan's official surrender in World War II, 11 phalanxes of People's Liberation Army, PLA soldiers, strutted through the heart of China, taking what viewers had been told would be exactly 128 steps, each stride a perfect 75 centimeters. Separately, guards of the national flag measured out 121 paces, each foot forward representing the number of years since 1894, when Imperial Japan began to carve up Chinese territory until its defeat in 1945. Above, air guard formations rendered a perfect 70 in the sky, marking the 7 decades since Japan's official surrender in World War II. 56 cannons were rolled out, one for each of China's official ethnic groups. The PLA band in chorus provided the syncopation, a drumbeat of 112 measures per minute. Training for the martial pageantry had been carried out with such dedication that, in the run-up to the parade, the 50 generals who were leading the foot formations lost an average of 11 pounds, according to Chinese state media. It was, for the casual observer sitting in Tiananmen Square on Thursday morning, under a flawlessly blue sky, difficult to judge the split-second accuracy of all the goose-stepping in China's largest military parade in nearly half a century. Did each soldier's stride measure exactly 75 centimeters? Were the tubas tooting in proper time? But the overall effect of 12,000 synchronized troops, 500 pieces of military equipment, some 200 aircraft overhead, not to mention nearly 1,000 foreign representatives from 17 countries who had joined the martial pageantry, was undeniable. Once devastated by more than a century of foreign occupation and humiliation, most recently by the Japanese during World War II, China had transformed into a world-class economic, military, and marching power. No longer were China's soldiers outfitted in the ragged clothes of the communist guerrillas, or more likely, that of their rival nationalists who did the bulk of their fighting against the Japanese. The Kuomintang, or nationalists, retreated to Taiwan in 1949, after losing the civil war to Chairman Mao Zedong's communist forces. The soldiers were not only sharply uniformed, but arranged so that they all appeared the same height. New fighter jets soared overhead, streaming pastel-hued contrails, and the latest in ballistic missile technology rolled past. Chinese state media said that 84% of the military hardware on display had been unveiled for the parade. You can never exaggerate the power of a strong military, Chinese military analyst Gao Feng tells Time. We Chinese have learned that we must have a strong army to protect our sovereignty and territorial integrity. Presiding over the martial liturgy was Xi Jinping, General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, Chairman of the Central Military Commission, and President of China, his titles in descending order of importance. Since taking power in November 2012, Xi, whose father was a communist revolutionary hero, against the Chinese nationalists, not the Japanese, has consolidated power rapidly. Perhaps in a sign of his authority, the September 3rd military display broke tradition as the first major procession not to take place on October 1st, the anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic in 1949. This was Xi's parade. In his opening speech, Xi vowed to trim the PLA by 300,000 forces in order to make it a meaner, leaner fighting force. China is embroiled in territorial disputes with various neighbors, particularly in the South China Sea. Some of the rest of his words were a pastiche of the various slogans and catchphrases of previous generations of communist leaders. The homage was personally directed. Gathered on the Tiananmen rostrum above Chairman Mao's portrait were not only the current members of China's seven-man standing committee, which steers the nation, but also Xi's predecessors, Hu Jintao and Jiang Zemin, along with former premiers Wen Jiabao, Xu Rongji, and Li Peng. The appearance of Jiang provoked a gasp from the audience at Tiananmen, not only because he was well enough to attend the parade at 89 years old, but also because Xi's massive anti-corruption campaign has netted many of Jiang's acolytes. Also surveying the troops, tanks, and aircraft were 30 world leaders, most from authoritarian nations or states with strong economic and ideological ties to China. Russia's Vladimir Putin, whose country suffered as terribly during World War II as China did, was the most prominent head of state to accept Xi's invitation. As the only other leader from one of the wartime allied powers to join the festivities, Putin was honored with the anchor position in a meet-and-greet with Xi. Most Western nations declined to send top-ranked representatives, but the gathered crowds cheered for South Korean President Park Geun-hye, who has brought her country closer to China, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and Egypt's Abdel Fattah al-Sisi also attended, along with political sympathizers like Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro, who secured lucrative oil loans with Beijing in the run-up to the parade. Perhaps the most notorious VIP was alleged war criminal Omar Hassan al-Bashir, the Sudanese president who was wanted by the International Criminal Court on charges of masterminding genocide. During their meeting in Beijing before the parade, Xi greeting al-Bashir as an old friend, and China has supplied weapons to Sudan. The U.S., by contrast, sent its ambassador to China, Max Baucus. Chinese state media stressed that the September 3rd event, initiated this year as a public holiday called the Commemoration of the 70th Anniversary of Victory of Chinese People's Resistance Against Japanese Aggression and World Anti-Fascist War, would help the world pursue peace. In his speech, Xi proclaimed that we Chinese love peace, before heading off in a sunroofed car to inspect the troops. Soon came the procession of tanks, their low rumble echoing a time 26 years ago when a lone protester stood up against a column of tanks before disappearing from history. Then the audience was treated to a march of missiles, including the much-hyped Dongfeng, East Wind, 21D, a never-before-seen hypersonic ballistic weapon that could target aircraft carriers and potentially force the U.S. Navy to rethink its reliance on such large ships. In the viewing stands at Tiananmen, elderly gentlemen with chests full of medals, mixed with young ethnic minorities, wearing the distinctive costumes and hats that they were encouraged to wear during official events. Occasional children wandered by, including an 8-year-old girl named Mandy Lee. "Today is a day to remember how much we hate the Japanese," she said as she walked along Tiananmen Square's western perimeter. "Now we will show the world how strong China is." Chinese textbooks emphasize the atrocities committed by Japanese during World War II, and in recent days, the airwaves and newspapers have been jammed with tales of Imperial Japan's brutality. Japanese invaders killed 2.2 million Chinese soldiers, readers of state media were reminded, and Imperial Japanese soldiers even raped and killed new mothers. China estimates that 35 million citizens died or were injured during the war. After the display of military might, the Beijing parade shifted gear to the kind of paying to peace that is more common in some other countries' war remembrances. Exactly 7,000 doves were released in the air in honor of Pacific sentiment, followed by a confetti of multicolored balloons. If the focus on the parade had been more doves and less goose-stepping, then perhaps more nations would have joined in. But as much as Xi may want to play to an international audience, the September 3rd show was primarily for the Chinese people. At a time of economic slowdown in China, patriotism may help the Chinese leader unite the masses. "So cool," gasped a Beijing academic in the viewing stand as the so-called carrier killer Dongfeng 21D missile rolled past. "Nobody can boss us around now." This article posted by Hannah Beach in Beijing.
Seeking to avert a 2016 disaster, the Republican National Committee on Wednesday challenged every GOP presidential candidate to sign a pledge not to undertake a third-party bid under any circumstances. The challenge, confirmed by multiple campaigns, is aimed squarely at Donald Trump, and the timing of the pledge suggests an agreement has been reached. While he is leading the packed Republican field in early polls, the billionaire businessman last month repeatedly threatened to launch a third-party bid, leaving open the possibility even at the GOP's first presidential debate last month, should he fail to claim the Republican presidential nomination. Such a decision would make it all but impossible for the Republican Party to win the White House in 2016. RNC officials have been working privately with Trump's campaign for several weeks to avert such a scenario. While neither side would publicly confirm late Wednesday that an agreement had been reached, Trump has hinted in recent days the GOP lobbying was beginning to work. The Trump campaign did not respond to questions about the pledge late Wednesday. RNC Chairman Reince Priebus is set to meet privately with Trump at his campaign headquarters in New York City shortly before Trump is scheduled to address reporters. The meeting was confirmed by two RNC officials who weren't authorized to discuss the plan publicly and requested anonymity. In recent days, Trump has suggested he would soon decide whether to rule out a third-party bid. "I think a lot of people are going to be very happy," he said Saturday in Nashville. Several candidates contacted late Wednesday confirmed that they would sign the pledge, among them Ohio Governor John Kasich and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, although few doubted the intentions of the vast majority of the GOP's 17 presidential contenders. The Republican National Committee's pledge asks candidates to promise to endorse the 2016 Republican presidential nominee regardless of who it is. Further, it asks them to pledge that I will not seek to run as an independent or write-in candidate, nor will I seek or accept the nomination for president of any other party. An RNC spokesman declined to comment. This article posted by Steve Peoples for the Associated Press in Washington. After a two-day standoff that kept 2,000 migrants out of the Keleti railway terminus, Hungarian authorities finally reopened the entrances to Budapest's central train station early Thursday, prompting hundreds of them to flood in and throng waiting trains. Complete pandemonium reigned as desperate refugees shoved children through open carriage windows in the hope of gaining passage to Germany, Reuters reported. However, signs in Hungarian announced that all trains to Western Europe had been canceled, while the Hungarian parliament held an unscheduled parliament session to debate solutions to its rapidly escalating role in the European Union's refugee crisis. The rush onto the platforms marked the end of a tense couple of days during which hundreds of migrants, mainly from the Middle East and Northern Africa, were stranded in the square outside the railway station after Hungary allowed thousands through on Monday but then decided to stop them from traveling further into Europe. In a repeat of the previous day's events, around 300 migrant protesters continued their cries of freedom, freedom, as they demanded to be let into the Keleti railway terminus to board trains for Austria and Germany. Hungarian authorities closed the station to the asylum-seeking refugees on Tuesday, despite letting thousands board trains earlier, and evacuated them from the station into the square outside. Hungarians with valid ID and foreigners with passports were allowed to proceed into the station as usual. Many of the hundreds of thousands of migrants that have flooded into Europe after crossing the Mediterranean Sea are making a beeline for countries like Germany, which announced earlier that it would grant asylum to Syrian refugees. The announcement came despite a European Union rule called the Dublin Regulation, which states that refugees must stay in the European country of their initial arrival until their asylum claims are processed. Traveling across Europe without proper documentation is also against EU law, a law Hungarian authorities cited as justification for barring the migrants from boarding trains despite many having bought tickets. A train ticket does not overwrite EU rules, a government spokesman said. Germany, Italy, and France called for a revision of those rules in a joint declaration, saying that there should be a fair distribution of migrants across the continent, according to the BBC. As Europe struggles to deal with the sudden influx of migrants fleeing violent conflict and crippling poverty, however, its countries remain divided over a solution. Hungary, which has become a flashpoint for the migrant crisis after the past week's incidents, has responded by erecting a barbed wire fence on its border with Serbia, from which many are entering, and may also employ limited use of its army at the border. The rhetoric of the Hungarian government has demonized certain groups of people in order to generate fear and thus justify security measures, such as the potential intervention of the army at the Hungarian-Serbian border, the group Migration Aid, which has been assisting migrants through the summer, said in a statement. This article posted by Rishi Iyengar. Thai police have named an eighth suspect in connection with the bombing of the Erawan Shrine in Bangkok on August 17, which killed 20 people and injured more than 120 others. An arrest warrant was issued Wednesday for Emre Davutoğlu, a Turkish man believed to be the husband of Thai suspect Wana Suansan, police spokesperson Prawit Thavern Siri said Wednesday, reports CNN. Davutoğlu has been charged with possession of war materials without permission, but police have not elaborated on his alleged involvement. 26-year-old Wana, a Muslim Thai national from the country's southern province, is wanted by police because authorities say they have linked her to the apartment where bomb-making materials were allegedly found. The woman, who CNN reports is believed to be in Turkey, has denied any involvement in the blasts and says she moved out of the apartment 1 year ago. Meanwhile, authorities arrested a foreign man believed to be the prime suspect in the bombing at the Thai-Cambodian border on Tuesday. This article posted by Helen Regan. The World Health Organization is to begin vaccinating about 200 people in Sierra Leone who came into contact with a woman who died from Ebola on Saturday. The woman, a 67-year-old from the Cambia district near the border with Guinea, died just 5 days after the country discharged its last known Ebola patient from the hospital, reports Reuters. Sierra Leone had begun a 42-day countdown to being declared Ebola-free, the last reported case of the disease being on August 8th. "We will vaccinate those who came into direct contact with the deceased and those contacts they also came into close contact with," said WHO spokesperson Margaret Harris. The head of the National Ebola Response Center in Sierra Leone, Paulo Conta, said more Ebola cases in the country are likely to be reported. Ebola experts are still investigating the source of transmission and have appealed to the niece of the woman to come forward as she was at high risk. Last year's deadly outbreak infected more than 28,000 people in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone and killed more than 11,300. This article posted by Helen Regan. Times the Brief is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code THEBRIEF at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
In recent weeks, all across Asia, there have been countless ceremonies, somber and solemn, to mark the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II in the Pacific. This titanic struggle officially came to a close on the battered, sun-baked deck of the USS battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay, with the Japanese military signing their surrender papers on September 2, 1945. Tokyo's defeat is being marked today in Beijing, where a massive military parade commemorates the 70th anniversary of what is known as the Victory of Chinese People's War of Resistance against Japanese Aggression and the World Anti-Fascist War. Far away, in the sleepy rural town of Chiran, in Japan's lush southern prefecture of Kagoshima, another far quieter ceremony has been held. Its location? The little-known Chiran Peace Museum. The museum, known locally as Toko Ihinkan, or Chapel of the Thunder Gods, is located at the end of a long row of pretty white birch trees, two white pillars at the entrance, and a gently arched gray-tiled roof give the building the look of a chapel. The grounds are covered with white gravel and landscaped with scores of cherry trees, pensive pines, and Japanese maples, the latter running deep red in the autumn months. In fact, the Chiran Peace Museum is dedicated to Japan's kamikaze pilots, the thousands of young men, most of them in their late teens or early 20s, who accepted certain death by flying their explosive-laden planes into approaching American warships in the name of national honor. In the final months of World War II, these young suicide pilots were trained to destroy approaching American ships by flying directly into them. In an attempt to boost morale, Japanese military commanders, themselves tucked safely away in bunkers in distant Tokyo, proclaimed the young pilots Thunder Gods, declaring that after the thunderous explosion of their airlines, the young men would become divine spirits. Japan's Imperial Command also bestowed on the flyers the term kamikaze, divine wind, a reference to the fierce typhoon winds that saved Japan from attacking Mongol fleets in the 13th century. Inside the museum are a number of World War II Japanese aircraft, but what catches the eye of most visitors are the many spotless display cases that hold such kamikaze artifacts left behind. Notebooks, goggles, diaries, wristwatches, and handmade dolls given to the pilots by female relatives. Lining the museum's walls are hundreds of black-and-white photos of the young pilots, each with a name and date of death in the order that they died. One of the most poignant photos shows five flyers holding a puppy. While the labels are in Japanese, Foreign visitors will have no trouble reading the emotion in the eyes of the pale young men as they gamely pose for a last toast before climbing into what were essentially their flying coffins. These are no wild-eyed ISIS killers. The aircraft more commonly used in the kamikaze flights was the infamous Mitsubishi Zero, also used for the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii in December 1941. However, as the war progressed and the Japanese military became more desperate, the nation unleashed the Oka, which means cherry blossom. The Oka was a petite wood and metal airplane specifically designed for kamikaze missions. Armed with a ton of explosives in its nose, the Oka was carried under the belly of a larger twin-engine Japanese bomber. During a mission, the Oka pilot would ride in the bomber until the target was within 25 to 50 miles. He would then climb down through the bomb bay and into the small Oka, pull a release lever, and be on his way. Though the little aircraft was primitive, it had a compass, an altimeter, and a toggle switch for firing the primitive propulsion rockets in its tail. By the time the Oka rammed into an American ship, it would have attained a speed of some 600 miles per hour, faster even than the average speed of today's jetliners. Just before impact, the pilot would pull a handle to arm the fuse of the nose explosives. Prior to kamikaze missions, Japanese pilots vowed to take a battleship for every aircraft, and when they did score direct hits, the damage was often immense, with hundreds of American sailors killed and countless more horribly burned. But in fact, personnel on the U.S. ships were able to blast many of the kamikazes out of the sky with anti-aircraft fire before the pilots reached their targets. No historian has ever determined exactly how many Japanese airmen perished in suicide attacks and under what circumstances. Eventually, every pilot in Japan's military was taught how to ram attack bombers, and many pilots died in individual, spontaneous attacks that were unrecorded. But it is believed that more than 1,000 kamikazes died in suicide attacks, and that more than a third of them were mere teenagers. In tribute, Tehran's main streets are lined with more than 1,000 stone lanterns representing each pilot. Japanese young people who visit the museum today find the experience a thought-provoking one. Satsuki Watanabe of Kagoshima City says she visits the museum whenever she's in the area. "I have heard that most of the pilots didn't think the war was necessary, but they compelled to defend their country," she says. "In history, I read that a lot of Japanese people thought that the war was a bad thing, but they had to do it." There's no question that the suicide missions aroused complex feelings in the young kamikazes. Some of the museum's artifacts hint at the pilots' torment. Letters bidding farewell to mothers, fathers, and sweethearts convey the writers' great sadness at having to die so young, as well as their devotion to both family and homeland. Some of the letters written by the pilots on their final night on Earth can be read in English via touchscreens. Just outside the museum, in a small, shady cedar forest, is a restored Army pilot's house where the kamikazes would stay until being sent out on their final missions. Here, the young flyers would write short messages or pen farewell notes and letters to their parents or loved ones. While most foreign visitors to the museum are well aware of the countless atrocities carried out by the Japanese in China and across East Asia, it is not difficult to see that these young flyers were also pawns controlled by Japan's hardcore military regime. Before the first Oka mission, staged in March 1945, the pilots took hair clippings and put them in boxes so that their parents would have something for funeral services. Each then wrote out a statement. One kamikaze pilot read, "May our death be as sudden as the shattering of crystal." On that first Oka mission, 18 Japanese Betty bombers carrying 15 Okas took off from Kanoya Air Base. They were protected by a flight of 30 Japanese fighter planes. But before the Okas could be released, 50 American fighter planes attacked the suicide squadron. At the end of the engagement, 160 Japanese, including all 15 of the mission's thunder gods, were dead. At the entrance of the Tehran Peace Museum, the purpose of the facility is stated as, to commemorate the pilots and expose the tragic loss of their lives so that we may understand the need for everlasting peace and ensure such incidents are never repeated. That is now our responsibility. This article posted by Stephen Nipp in Chiran.
Like Amazon and Yahoo, auction website eBay is one of those old guard internet companies that's still having a big impact today. On Thursday, eBay celebrates its 20th birthday, meaning it's a great time to look back at the site's history. Here's everything you need to know about the iconic auction site on its 20th birthday. The history. September 3, 1995. Software developer Pierre Omidyar founds AuctionWeb, which would be renamed eBay 2 years later as an experimental global online marketplace. One of the first items sold was a broken laser pointer for $14.83. September 1998. eBay goes public, and that same month also boasts over 1 million registered users for the first time. July 8, 2002, eBay announces its acquisition of PayPal for $1.4 billion in stock after failing to establish its own e-payment service. April 2004, eBay boasts over 100 million registered users for the first time. September 26, 2013, eBay announces its $800 million acquisition of payments gateway Braintree, which had acquired social payment startup Venmo. July 17, 2015. eBay and PayPal split into two companies after 13 years, bowing to pressure from activist investor Carl Icahn. By the numbers, most expensive sale. It's believed to be an $85 million deposit on a 405-foot, $170 million mega-yacht called the Giga-Yacht. Best eBay sellers. eStocks, a UK-based CD, DVD, and video game seller, had over 800,000 positively reviewed sales during the first half of 2015, the most of any seller. Babs, a UK-based business item retailer, boasts a total of more than 5 million positively reviewed sales. Total sales in 2014, $83 billion in gross merchandise sales, 157 million active buyers worldwide, 800 million listings at any given time, 25 million sellers on the eBay marketplace. eBay fun facts. A cornflake shaped like Illinois sold for $1,350 in 2008 to a trivia website owner. A pair of shoes sells every 2 seconds in the U.S. A car is bought via mobile device every 2 minutes in the U.K. Justin Timberlake's half-eaten French toast sold for $1,025 in 2000. This article posted by Heather Jones and Jack Lynchy. Ongoing conflicts across the Middle East have prevented more than 13 million children from attending school, according to a report published Thursday by UNICEF. The report states that 40% of all children across the region are currently not receiving an education, a crisis it attributes to two repercussions of violence: the displacement of populations and structural damages to the schools themselves. Both issues stem from the tide of violence that has crossed the region in recent years. The report examines 9 countries, Syria, Palestine, Libya, Yemen, Sudan, Iraq, Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan, where a state of war has become the norm. Across the region, violence has rendered 8,500 schools unusable. In certain cases, communities have relied on school buildings to function as makeshift shelters for the displaced, with up to 9 families living in a single classroom in former schools across Iraq. The document's authors pay particularly close attention to Syria, where a bloody civil war has displaced at least 9 million people since the war began in 2011. With the crisis now in its 5th year, basic public services inside Syria, including education, have been stretched to the breaking point, the report reads. Within the country, the quality and availability of education depends on whether the relevant region is suffering violence, a reliably unpredictive metric. In states nearby, which have steadily received streams of Syrian refugees, governments have shown generosity toward Syrian children, but the demands have far outstretched their limited resources. 53% of Syrian refugee children whose families have fled to nearby host countries, specifically Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, and Egypt, are currently out of school. The report concludes with an entreaty to international policymakers to apportion financial and other resources to the regional crisis. With more than 13 million children already driven from classrooms by conflict, it is no exaggeration to say that the educational prospects of a generation of children are in the balance, it reads. The forces that are crushing individual lives and futures are also destroying the prospects for an entire region. This article posted by Nash Jenkins. Nearly 900,000 military veterans have officially pending applications for health care from the Department of Veterans Affairs, the department's inspector general said Wednesday, but serious problems with enrollment data make it impossible to determine how many veterans were actively seeking VA health care. About one-third of the 867,000 veterans with pending applications are likely deceased, the report says, adding that data limitations prevent investigators from determining how many now deceased veterans applied for health care benefits or when. The applications go back nearly two decades, and officials said some applicants may have died years ago. More than half the applications listed as pending as of last year do not have application dates, and investigators could not reliably determine how many records were associated with actual applications for enrollment in VA healthcare, the report said. The report also says VA workers incorrectly marked thousands of unprocessed healthcare applications as completed and may have deleted 10,000 or more electronic transactions over the past 5 years. Linda Halliday, the VA's acting inspector general, said the agency's Health Eligibility Center has not effectively managed its business processes to ensure the consistent creation and maintenance of essential data and recommended a multi-year plan to improve accuracy and usefulness of agency records. Halliday's report came in response to a whistleblower who said more than 200,000 veterans with pending applications for VA health care were likely deceased. The Inspector General's report substantiated that claim and others, but said there was no way to tell for sure when or why the person died. Similarly, deficiencies in the VA's information security, including a lack of audit trails and system backups, limited investigators' ability to review some issues fully and rule out data manipulation, Halliday said. The VA has said it has no way to purge the list of dead applicants and said many of those listed in the report are likely to have used another type of insurance before they died. VA spokeswoman Walinda West said Wednesday the agency has publicly acknowledged that its enrollment process is confusing and that the enrollment system, data integrity, and quality are in need of significant improvement. Senators Johnny Isaacson and Richard Blumenthal, chairman and senior Democrat of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, said in a joint statement that the Inspector General's report pointed to both a significant failure by leaders at the Health Eligibility Center and deficient oversight by the VA Central Office in Washington. The lawmakers urged the VA to implement the report's recommendations quickly to improve record-keeping at the VA and ensure that this level of blatant mismanagement does not happen again. As of June 30th, the VA has contacted 302,045 veterans by mail, asking them to submit required documents to establish eligibility, West said. To date, the VA has received 36,749 responses and enrolled 34,517 veterans, she said. As we continue our work to contact veterans, our focus remains on improving the enrollment system to better serve veterans, West said. The Health Eligibility Center has removed a purge and delete functionality from a computer system used to track agency workloads, West said. The VA will provide 6 months of data to demonstrate that any changed or deleted data on VA workloads has undergone appropriate management review with approvals and audit trails visible, she said. This article posted by Matthew Daly for the Associated Press in Washington. In a Republican primary filled with notes of fear and anger, John Kasich is heading in the other direction. We're spending too much time being negative about our lives, and I don't think that's very healthy, Kasich says, warning of a nationwide morale problem, because when we are positive, we come together to solve our problems. On the campaign trail, the Ohio governor is sounding more like a self-help guru than presidential candidate, preaching optimism and the importance of rebuilding community. He tells college-aged kids to keep reaching for the stars and seniors to focus on positivity. You have to be a person who represents a place of justice and healing, he tells the several dozen students among the crowd at his town hall at New England College in this quaint New Hampshire town. Changing the world doesn't mean becoming president. Changing the world means that you do something special for somebody else, living outside of yourself. As the Republican presidential field has devolved into a contest to see who can best display and capture the angst and anger of the GOP electorate, especially as candidates like former Florida Governor Jeb Bush takes on frontrunner Donald Trump, Kasich is trying a radically different course, encouraging the country to count its blessings. We're constantly pummeled with all the bad things that go on in our country, but where else would we want to live, he said at a town hall Wednesday in New London. Kasich says he was called to the new message because of all the negativity he's seen from voters and his fellow candidates. I just get a little tired of everybody running around moping about how terrible everything is, he tells Time. There are some real issues, but if you keep hearing about how bad everything is all the time, you start getting negative, he adds, comparing it to a football coach who only points out his players' faults. Pretty soon you have a morale problem on the team. Kasich, who has a reputation as a prickly executive but has effectively masked it on the trail, said he decided to emphasize a more positive message in recent days after realizing the magnitude of the negativity. His tone is more reminiscent of the joyful tortoise campaign Bush set out to run, but has now abandoned as he goes toe-to-toe with Trump. On Wednesday morning, Kasich bristled at a reporter who questioned this strategy, turning it into a new stump speech line. Following an event in Hooksett at the historic Robies County store, Kasich was asked by a reporter whether he was angry enough to win the presidency. If it takes mean and angry, count me out, he says later, referencing the question in his subsequent events. I'm going to remember that for a very long time. If it takes determination, if it takes a degree of toughness, count me in, he continues. But we've got too much to be thankful for in this country to be waking up in a bad mood. Don't let them get you down. It was that problem, he says, that contributed to former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney's loss in 2012, particularly when the then GOP nominee campaigned in Ohio, warning of economic collapse when the state's economy was recovering. I don't think that was the right message, he says, adding, it's ancient history. Kasich has taken to using his stump speech to encourage a rebuilding of community, telling the story of his childhood neighbor calling his parents to tell them he was sledding into traffic in the street. We need to start sticking our noses into other people's business and start rebuilding and re-strengthening our communities, Kasich said in Hooksett, a line that drew titters from Democrats and questions from fellow Republican candidates for appearing to support the notion of big government. Kasich, who has come under fire from many Republicans for his decision to expand Medicaid in Ohio under the Affordable Care Act, defended the comments. I think it's a very conservative and Republican line, because if neighbors are helping neighbors, then government doesn't have to do as much, Kasich tells Time. I think rebuilding communities is a part of rebuilding America. This article posted by Zeke J. Miller in Henniker, New Hampshire. Two North Carolina brothers were awarded $750,000 each in compensation Wednesday for the 3 decades they were wrongfully imprisoned in the killing of an 11-year-old girl. Henry McCullum, 51, appeared calm as a North Carolina commission formally awarded the money to him and half-brother Leon Brown, 47, during a hearing. Brown is in the hospital, suffering from health problems, including post-traumatic stress disorder, the brother's lawyer said, and did not attend. McCullum and Brown were released last September after a judge threw out their convictions, citing new DNA evidence that points to another man in the 1983 rape and killing of Sabrina Bowie. McCullum had been the longest-serving inmate on North Carolina's death row. Brown had been sentenced to life in prison. McCullum, who has been living with his sister, said he is happy the money will enable him to support himself and help his family. "My family, they have struggled for years and years," he said. "It's hard out there for them, and I want to help them." The governor pardoned the brothers in June, a step that made each eligible to receive $50,000 from the state for every year spent in prison, with a limit of $750,000. They can also receive educational benefits from the state. Their attorney said the money will be put in a trust and invested so that the brothers can live off the earnings and won't have to work. In the months since their release, both men have had trouble adjusting to the outside world after spending most of their adult lives in prison. Money has been a problem, but McCullum has said the most important part of the pardon was having his name cleared. McCullum listed some of the things he enjoys about freedom. Being out here, to be able to breathe the air, to be able to walk around as a free man, to be able to walk down that street with my head up high. Sabrina's body was found in a soybean field in rural Robeson County, cigarette butts, a beer can, and two bloody sticks nearby. Defense attorneys have said the brothers were scared teenagers with low IQs when they were questioned by police and coerced into confessing. McCullum was 19, Brown 15. The DNA from the cigarettes didn't match Brown or McCullum, and fingerprints on the beer can weren't theirs either. No physical evidence connects them to the crime, a prosecutor acknowledged last year. Both men were initially given death sentences. In 1988, the state Supreme Court threw out their convictions and ordered new trials. McCullum was again sent to death row, while Brown was convicted of rape and sentenced to life. The men's sister, Geraldine Brown, said that she is happy for her brothers, but that the pardon and compensation are bittersweet, considering that Leon Brown is really sick from his time in prison. She said he suffers mental problems, including PTSD as well as diabetes. "He did not go in that way," she said. "They snatched him from my mother as a baby." The brothers' attorney sued Robeson County, the town where the killing happened, the sheriff, and others on Monday in federal court on behalf of the men. The lawsuit said the men's civil rights were violated and seeks unspecified damages. This article posted by the Associated Press in Raleigh, North Carolina. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.